Give me just a moment to soak in Sunday morning. How wonderful is it to get together like this? I do have a good word this morning. If it's within the covers of the book, it's always good. I want to talk to you about being faithful to the finish line. So many times in life, people start to do something and they never finish it. Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived, said, "It's better to finish a thing than it is to begin it." And when it comes to the Christian journey and our life as believers, we are called not only to get into the race, not only to run this race, but we're called to be faithful and finish this race. Now, Paul wrote more than half of the New Testament. He wrote many letters to his sons in the Lord or to church congregations all over the known world in his day. But the last letter Paul wrote was his farewell. He knew this would be the last letter. He knew as he wrote these words, this would be his dying words. And in 2 Timothy chapter 4, beginning at verse 6, writing to his spiritual son, Paul said, "For I am already being poured out as a drink offering." Now, when he said that to the people in his day, and even those of us today are aware, during the Old Covenant, thousands of years of worshiping God, the way they did it before Christ, is a sacrifice. An animal would be brought and would be offered to the Lord. And when an animal was sacrificed in worship to God, it had several components. There was a meat offering and a burnt offering, but the very last finishing touch of the offering sacrificed to God was the drink offering. And when Paul said, "I'm already being poured out as a drink offering," what he was saying was, I realize my life has been a living sacrifice. I have lived my life as a sacrifice to God. But at this moment, the finishing touch of the sacrifice of my life is what's happening here. This is a drink offering to the Lord. And then he said, "And the time of my departure is at hand." These are the dying words of a dying man. And he said, and this could have been his epitaph, "I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, and I have kept the faith." When he said, "The time of my departure is at hand," that word departure in his day was a ship term, a maritime term. When a person was launching a ship out to sea, the last thing that would happen before all the equipment was on board and after all of the people setting sail was on board, they would unravel the mooring rope that had kept the ship stable at the dock. And when everything was on board and it was ready to set sail, the departure would take place. That's when someone on the shore would unravel the mooring rope that had kept the ship at dock. Now, when the departure, the removing of the rope, was finished, that ship was ready to set sail out into the deep. So Paul is giving his dying words, and he knew it when he said it. It was as if Paul, in the scripture right here, was preaching his own memorial service. He knew He knew this is not just the fourth quarter of my life. He knew I'm not just in the final home stretch of my life, but he knew he was facing imminent death, and it could come any hour or any day. Now, people don't like to talk about dying, but there is a funeral in all of our future, every single one of us. Paul's last letter, written to his spiritual son Timothy, was written while he was in a Roman prison cell. He was on death row, and he knew it. He was awaiting execution, which would happen. He was beheaded, decapitated, because of his strong faith in Christ. And even though he knew any hour, any day, they will come and get me out of this room and take me to be executed. Even though he knew that as he was writing the book of 2 Timothy, he was not wallowing in self-pity. He was not discouraged. He was not brokenhearted. He was not playing the poor old pitiful me card. There was not one hint of desperation or hopelessness in what he wrote, even while he was facing immediate death. And I'm sure he had some time in that cell on death row to consider, what will my legacy be? That's something that all of us should think about at some point. What will your legacy be? The day will come when it really will not matter the size of the home you lived in, what kind of car you drove. It won't even really matter all that much how much money you have in the bank. Legacy for God's people means so much more than that. Legacy involves the heritage that was passed down to us in trust, how we handle it during our lifetime, and how we pass it on to the generation following us. What will your legacy be? I'm sure Paul had plenty of time in that prison cell to ask himself that question. Exactly what will my legacy be? After I'm dead and gone, will my life have mattered in a long term? He was facing death by beheading. And did you know that the early New Testament apostles, you'll read about them in the book of Acts, almost all of them were killed, martyred, because of their faith. And none of them ever renounced their faith. Even facing imminent execution, none of them ever renounced their faith. I'll tell you why. It's because they had been there with him. They had known him. They had watched him perform miracles. They were convinced without a single doubt that he was the Son of God, and everything in their life that mattered was based on that fact, and they knew it. You couldn't talk them out of it. Even gun to the head, they would die for their faith. That's the legacy the founding fathers of our church have left behind. Now, Paul, in this cell where he wrote this letter to Timothy, took a moment to be reflective. He said, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. What Paul is saying is, I didn't just start out in this race and later quit the race. But Paul said, I'm determined to cross the finish line. and even facing death by beheading was no big deal to him, because he said, I've gotten used to dying a little bit every day. He said, I die daily as a lifestyle for quite some time now. Before Paul was being executed because of his faith, day by day he had dethroned the flesh to the point to where he could write honestly to the church at Rome and saying, my life is a living sacrifice. He would write to the church at Galatia and say, it is no longer Paul living this life, but now it is Christ living his life through Paul. He said, I've gotten used to dying a little bit every day. I die daily. And then he was able to say, before he was on death row facing execution for his faith, for me to live is Christ, but the day I die will be gain for me. It's a totally different perspective when you look through eternity's filter. I heard the story one time of a man who was dying. He was on his deathbed. His family called for the pastor. The pastor went to the bedside of the dying man. The family stepped out of the room to give their loved one who was on his deathbed and the pastor a private moment together. And as soon as all the family had left the room, the pastor asked the dying man, are you afraid to die? And that dying man said, no, I'm not afraid to die. I'm ashamed to die. I'm ashamed that I've not lived my life fully as I should have lived and run the race that I should have run and fought the good fight I should have fought. I'm not afraid to die. I'm ashamed to die. Now, Paul said, I have kept the faith. Keeping the faith. The English language is poor and pitiful. It's a short language. Other languages of the world have a lot more words in their vocabulary than English. We can love our wife and we can love our cat and we can love apple pie and hot dogs. All love. The Russian language has four times as many words as the English language. It's a more colorful language. And the Greek language is more bountiful and more abundantly colorful than the English language. So when Paul says, I have kept the faith, that word kept or to keep is a pitiful word in English. But in the Greek language, it is a military term Paul was using that expresses the idea of soldiers standing faithfully at their post of duty by the city gates to guard and control all who went in and out of the city. The keepers were the gate monitors. That's how important and how strong of a word that is. Paul said, I have kept the faith. He meant, I have guarded it. I have monitored the faith. I have been careful to oversee what would pass through my faith and what I would not allow to be a part of my faith. I have preserved and protected and guarded the faith that God has given me. And it's interesting that if I knew I was going to die this afternoon, if I knew that I'm on death row and any hour now I could take my last breath, and especially if I knew the reason why I'm going to be executed is because of my faith in God, I may write a slightly different letter than Paul wrote. But his faith was so strong, and we need to learn that faith requires a consistent attitude of confidence toward God. Even facing death any moment now, I'm going to be executed. But he maintained and displayed a consistent attitude of his confidence in God. You know, we could audit our own life just to see where we are in the faith and how well we are keeping and guarding and protecting our faith. Now, just imagine how many opportunities Paul had to quit. He said, I have fought the good fight. I have run the race. I have kept the faith. I've kept it. He didn't stop and give up. But imagine how many opportunities he had to quit. Listen to just some of the things Paul went through. Now, I know you have your stories and I have mine of what I've been through in my life, what you've been through in your life. And perhaps some, minimally, have been because of your faith. I don't know. We're blessed to live in a nation where right now, at least, we're not persecuted like some nations are being persecuted for their Christian faith, even right now today. Paul said in Corinthians that he had been beaten with 39 stripes on 5 different occasions. Now, to put that in context briefly, whatever the legal system was, which was so unjust in his day, imagine going to court in your own trial for obeying God and honoring your faith and preserving your faith, which is the most important thing in the world to Paul and to you. Your own trial, and you're before a judge or a jury. They're trying to find out whether you're guilty or innocent. And they sentence you to being beaten 39 times with a whip on your back. Imagine how many times Paul had opportunity to quit. I would consider as soon as the judge passed sentence, oh, before I get the first lash on my back, that was an opportunity to bail. But no, he didn't. What about after the first lash? Could possibly a thought have shot through his head? Now's a good time. You don't have to suffer anymore. That was only one. You've got 38 more coming right now. Between the first and the second lash, I would have called that an opportunity to quit. But he didn't. Right on up, 35, 36, 37, 38 lashes. By now his back is a bloody pulp and he's in such pain. And still another one to come. An opportunity to quit, but he didn't. He took that 39th stripe and kept his faith. And that was just the first of 5 legal proceedings where they falsely pronounced him guilty and his punishment was 39 more stripes. And with each stripe, an opportunity to quit. Take the easy way out. And just bail. He said, in addition to that, 3 times I was beaten with rods. Now, that's still a punishment in some countries. In fact, even China today, as a part of their punishment, will beat you with rods. It's court-ordered and sanctioned. It's called caning today. Paul said, 3 times I was beaten with rods. And there was one occasion he said, the mob was stoning me to death. And everybody in the crowd picked up a rock and stoned me. And they left me thinking I was dead. Then he said, I was shipwrecked. And lost at sea. And I survived a day and a night in the open sea. Boy, that would have been a good time as soon as you get to land after that. So, you know, no more of this. I'm out. Count me out. But he didn't. He said, I've been obeying God, and there have been times I've been hungry and didn't have enough to eat. There have been times I've been thirsty and didn't have clean water to drink. He said, I've faced every imaginable danger while I've been serving God. He said, I've been attacked by robbers and thieves. I've been stabbed in the back by even church members that I've been ministering to at times. Boy, he had so many opportunities. And don't we all? Something don't go just right. God doesn't answer a prayer the way we wanted him to answer it. So many reasons and so many opportunities to just quit running the race. But here's the truth. Sobering truth. We are not promised a life of ease and comfort. What we are promised is persecution. And when Paul wrote this, the church was being persecuted. I'll say that the church today is being persecuted, much more so in other nations than in the United States. Now, our nation needs prayer. We definitely need healing. So much division. But there are nations where the Christians who love God like we do, who believe in God like we do, cannot get together like this for fear of being jailed or tortured or even killed. It's happening right now. If you obey God and the call of God on your life, you will have opportunities to throw up your hands and quit. We need to follow the example of Paul. When we get to the end of our journey, we need to be able to say, I have fought the good fight. I have run the race and I have kept the faith. So many, when he wrote this, were already departing from the faith. And you can only imagine, 2,000 years ago, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, born as a baby, grew up, changed the world, was crucified and resurrected back to life, and that's the foundation of our faith in God. And everybody was caught up in this miraculous new move of God. It was the first time in their lifetime and the first time ever in the history of the world a generation was alive to see God has kept his promise. He has sent the Messiah. Our forefathers and the prophets from centuries ago have told us would come. So they were all in. They saw the miracles. You know what it is. Maybe you've been to some of them churches where you get goosebumps. I had a goosebump here this morning. Everybody feeling real good. Oh, I mean, who wouldn't want to get in on this? And they left Judaism. They had been Jewish, Orthodox Jews, which means they had grown up being told, you've got to keep the law. Now, if you want to be in good position with God, you've got to keep the law. Now, here's the top 10. But it's much more than that. There is the Levitical law. You can't do this or that or the other, or you'll be on the outs with God. Now, the only way to have a right standing before God is to keep every one of these laws and not break a single one all of your life. Good luck with that. Now, they had been brought up thinking that. All of a sudden, they know the grace of God has been manifest in the life of Jesus Christ. And he preaches a different gospel altogether. He said about the law, let's show it some respect but I've come to fulfill it. Everybody was joining the church. Everybody was happy to be free from legalism and the expectation of keeping the law until persecution came. And some new believers that had goosebumps galore just a little earlier were having second thoughts about keeping the faith. They were under persecution and they were bailing left and right. They were saying, you know, this Christian thing, it was a fad maybe. It was good. I really enjoyed the ride. It was something fresh and new and wonderful, and I'm glad I was in on it. But you know, I don't like this persecution. I was a lot more comfortable, come to think about it, being a Jew. I'm going to go back to Judaism. And they washed their hands of the faith. They thought it was the safe thing, the easy thing, the convenient thing for sure, to go back. That's why this same man that wrote these dying words, I have fought the good fight, I have run the race, I have kept the faith. That same man wrote to a church, the Galatians, in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 1, and he just told it like it was to this group of Christians, they called themselves. He said, "Oh, foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth?" And then in verse 3, he said, "How foolish can you be after starting your Christian lives in the Spirit? Why are you now trying to become perfect by your own human effort? Who has bewitched you?" That was a hard word. Paul is writing to the church, and it was a new church. All churches were new in his day. He said, "Who has cast an evil spell? Who has bewitched you like this, that you're no longer keeping the faith that you've been given? But because of persecution, you're going back to the BC days, thinking it's more convenient." Now, the question is, are we keeping? Are we guarding? Are we preserving? Are we committed to keeping our faith all the way to the finish line, like Paul did? Jesus addressed this. The words are written in red in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 2. He spoke to one church and said, "I know your works." Now he commended them. We're a working church. We believe in good works. Won't save us, but they will glorify God if we do it the right way. Our works matter. And Jesus wrote to this church and said, "I know your works." Thumbs up. "Your labor." Thumbs up. "Your patience." Thumbs up. And then Jesus said, "And I know, as a church, you cannot tolerate those who are evil." Thumbs up. But then, Revelation 2 and 4, Jesus said, "Nevertheless, I have this against you, that you have left your first love." You've left your first love. When you first got into the faith, you were all in, head over heels. And how easy it is to leave the place of your first love. The Message translation says, "Do you have any idea how far you've fallen?" So many times in this race, and aren't we busier now than ever? We have 800 channels on our TV that we've got to find out what's on the other channels. I mean, we're never happy with what this, but what's on the other 800? We're just busier these days. It's easy to fall away from that place of first love. I want to tell you about two conversations Brenda and I have. We have them like clockwork, religiously. One conversation takes place every month. Brenda and I have had this conversation every month for 45 years. When the electric bill comes, she opens it. And every month we've had this conversation. It goes exactly like this. She says, "Darling, our electric bill this month was whatever, whatever, whatever." And I always say, "Every month, well, I think we ought to pay it, don't you?" That's the conversation we have every month. Like religion, as soon as the electric bill comes, I know what's going to happen. She's going to open it, and she's going to tell me dollars and cents how much our electric bill is. And I'm going to always reply, "Well, I think we ought to pay it, don't you?" Don't you accuse me of that. I'm just saying I know how important our electricity is all. I think we ought to pay it. Now, that's the conversation that happens every month. Here's the conversation that happens every night. Brenda's worried now. Oh, she's sweating over here on the amen corner. Every night, I go to sleep before she does, and I wake up before she does. That's just our life. I love to get up early, which means I go to sleep early. So we're in bed, and the TV's on, and I'm not even going to say we watch Christian TV all the time. I'm not even going to lie about that. But the TV's on, you know, and it's in the background, and I'm getting sleepier than she is. And every single night of our life, this is the conversation. "Don't have to worry about it, darling. This is all right." Yeah. I always have the remote in my hand. Always. And right before I realize, "Oh, I just cannot stay awake much longer," I'll give her the remote. What? I do. She takes the remote. Anyhow, she winds up with the remote, and I will turn over and get my, and she will ask me this question every single night. "Are you going to sleep now?" And my answer is always this, always. I never say, "Yeah, I'm going to sleep now," or "No, not yet." My answer to her question, "Are you going to sleep now?" And my answer is always this: "I'm drifting."
You need to tell the truth. We watch what you want to watch, and I only get to watch what I want to watch.
Ushers, take her out. I work alone, young lady. Well, I already admitted I hold the remote, so it's a given that we watch what I want to watch. But now here's the question. "Are you going to sleep now?" And I never say, "Yeah." I always say, "I'm drifting." Now, a drift is a continuous slow movement from one place to another. She'll ask, "Are you going to sleep now? You ready to go to sleep?" And I never say, "Yeah." I will say, "I'm drifting." And that's where a lot of us are as we keep the faith. Doesn't happen quickly when we lose our faith. Sometimes it evaporates slowly. It's a continuous slow movement from one place of being strong in the faith to another place of losing hold of your faith. Don't bail. Don't even drift. Recapture your first love if you've moved from that place. This is something that's in the news. I'm referring to this. I'll give you from the Christian Post. You can Google it and see exactly what I have. The title of this article is "High profile Christians who are renouncing their faith. I won't read it all, just a little bit. So many prominent Christian personalities are turning from the faith. It seems, though, it's becoming a regular occurrence. Do we like Hillsong music? Hillsong ministry? Hillsong songwriter Marty Sampson wrote and posted on his Instagram, "Time for some real talk." I'm quoting here. "I am losing my faith. Christians can be the most judgmental people on the planet. It's not for me. I am not in anymore." I was alive and in ministry years ago. For those of you who are millennials, you may not remember this, but it was a best-selling book, and it hit the market at just the right time. It was a book in the late 90s called "I Kissed Dating Goodbye." Anybody remember hearing about that book? Great book. It was relevant in its day, not so much now, but it was then. It hit the church at just the right time. It spoke to purity and things that was evaporating. "I Kissed Dating Goodbye." It raised the standard for young people in their dating years. And it was well received and embraced. It was written by a man named Joshua Harris. After he wrote that book, he went on to become a pastor of a mega church in Maryland. And just last year, he renounced his Christian faith. He said, "I have undergone a massive shift in regard to my faith in Jesus. The popular phrase for this," he said, "is deconstruction. The biblical phrase is falling away." Then he said, "By all the measurements I have for defining a Christian, I am not one." Dave Gass, G-A-S-S, pastor of a church called Covenant Church, on social media announced, and I'm quoting him, "After 40 years of being a devout follower of Christ, 20 of those being an evangelical pastor, I am walking away from the faith. This decision has been decades in the making." The latest high-profile Christian personality to renounce his faith is Paul Maxwell, the well-known author of the Desiring God books. Imagine writing best-selling books, the title Desiring God. And he said, and I quote, "What I really miss is the people. I'm not ready to be angry anymore. It's important to say, though, that I'm just not a Christian anymore." After he wrote those great books, Desiring God. Mama. Drifting. A continuous slow movement from one place to another. Matthew 24 and verse 13, Jesus addresses this, and we need to hear his word today. "But he who endures to the end shall be saved." It's really not good enough to come to church and play church games. We need to check how committed we are to keeping our faith no matter what. Now, we are protected from a lot of persecution right now, but it could change in a day, even in our nation. I've been to many other nations to where they can't boldly greet one another with a Christian greeting, not publicly, not on the streets, for fear of being imprisoned or tortured or even killed. It's wonderful to drive through the Burger King drive-thru and the kind lady who hands you your coffee says, as you are about to drive away, "Have a blessed day." And we know that's code. That's a sister right there. That's a sister or a brother telling me, come on and have yourself a blessed day. We don't need to take that for granted. Some of our brothers and sisters don't have it now as good as we do. Jesus said, the one that will be saved is the one that endures to the end, no matter what. And to explain that further, Jesus gave the parable of the sower sowing the word. And you know, there were four types of soil. The word is always good. The word is always quality. God's word, there's never an issue with God's word. The issue always is the soil that receives the word. There were four types. You know, the sower sows the word. But about one type of soil, the stony ground, Jesus described the person who will hear the word and put it on stony ground. It's about like, if you can imagine, going out here to the asphalt parking lot, which, by the way, don't our new asphalt parking lot look really nice? And throwing a seed on the asphalt and expecting a harvest to ever come up. Sowing a seed of the word on stony ground, Jesus said, here's what that's like. When the word goes forth and a person receives it on stony ground, Jesus said their initial reaction to the word is gladness. They receive it with gladness. But before he got to a period in that sentence, he said they received the word with gladness but have no root in themselves. So, Jesus said, they endure but for a time. I mean, I'm calling into question this morning for each of us. How committed are we to enduring, keeping the faith until we get to the finish line? Are we drifting or are we enduring to the end? We are called to be faithful to the finish line. Called to be faithful to the finish line. Would you stand with me, please? Everybody stand. Bow your heads.